This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 227 was recorded on July 9th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Who could forget Hugh Hendry, the iconic and usually outspoken Scottish hedge fund manager? We last interviewed on Macro Voices the very day that he announced the closure of his fund, Eclectica Asset Management, back in 2017. Well, he's back, making a splash in the world of macro, with a new YouTube channel and a new white paper suggesting that podcaster Joe Rogan should replace Jay Powell as Fed chairman. Hugh joins me as this week's feature interview guest to discuss everything from Caribbean real estate to his comeback in the world of macro. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick will talk us through another one of his signature chart decks.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 looked like it was pretty bullish last week in that breakout, but it's more or less been very trade range bound all week, just not ready to commit to a big move either way. Do you think the path of least resistance is still higher? What's your thinking?
I have to laugh, Patrick. You know, we've seen mounting evidence that the COVID crisis is worsening, certainly in terms of infections, breaking 60,000, almost 62,000 yesterday. New record, that's about 70% higher than the record set back at the beginning of April for new cases. Now, the deaths have not caught up with that yet. I think that still is some lag factor, although there is increasing evidence that maybe the deaths are not going to pick up as much as people feared. But still, nothing can seem to shake the stock market. You know, it was holding pretty darn steady through all of that. And then news comes out that the president has to reveal his tax returns, and all of a sudden the market starts to crash. I think that was temporary. I think that was a little bit of a panic. But what it does say to me, Patrick, is that, you know, election expectations are going to play an increasing role of importance now through the actual election. I think it's going to get more and more important every week. As far as where we stand right now on stock market, you know, I think Charlie McElligott really hit the nail on the head last week when he pointed out that with the VIX coming down, it allows a lot of systematic traders to get back into the market, building up their positions. I don't know how much longer that lasts, though. What's going to be the next leg after that, after the VIX has come down and those traders have come back into the marketplace? We'll see what happens. I think that from an economic fundamental standpoint, there's a very good bearish case. But so far, what we've seen is expectations around more stimulus have outweighed those bearish factors from expectations of a worsening economy.
All right, well, let's move on to that U.S. dollar, which remains relatively weak. We haven't seen any big technical breakdown. I want to talk about this in the post game as well. But really, at this stage, a very weak price action, holding down below 97 handle right now. Is the next move down still?
Well, it seems like the evidence is starting to mount a little bit more in the bearish direction, but really we're still in a sideways consolidation. We'll look at a chart of this in the postgame segment, but as I see this chart, you know, it is looking kind of weak here, but we've only had one daily close below 96, and that resulted in a very prompt rebound higher. So another close below 96 on the dollar index would be the first clear sign to me that this chart really is looking weak. And then, of course, below 94.5, which was that previous low, that would really mean game on for the bearish case. So I don't think that we've quite got a decisive signal yet, but it's looking more and more like maybe a bearish outcome is more likely.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because crude looked like it was just pinned all week, just in an incredibly tight range, almost a dollar range, almost every day. And then today, we get a breakdown on the August contract below 40. Is this the beginning of some sort of a correction, or is this just noise?
Well, Patrick, that remains to be seen. What I found most interesting was after yesterday's inventory report, as you say, that August contract just kept on holding on there, right around $41. But the back of the curve time spreads rolled over yesterday on Wednesday. It wasn't until Thursday, and I guess the news about the president's tax return helped as a catalyst to get things going, but it wasn't really until Thursday morning that the front month contract took a nosedive. But the move in the back of curve time spreads, anything after June 21, those time spreads started diving yesterday. Now, they are oftentimes an early warning sign of what's to come for the rest of the market. I suppose the other side of that would be that RBOB gasoline is also an early tell in many cases. And as of yesterday, it was still holding pretty strong, but it's looking quite a bit weaker today. Inventory this week was a surprise build of 5.7 million barrels nationally. Now, that's in addition to 0.6 million barrels of what really is commercial storage that got pumped into the government's Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So net of the SPR build, that's a 6.3 million barrel build on commercial storage. That's pretty darn big. And that's after a series of quite a few drawdowns that we had seen. So this storage crisis is not over yet. Cushing, Oklahoma, building 2.2 million barrels. That's notable because we've had a series of, I think, 7 or 8 drawdowns as we saw oil being moved out of Cushing, Oklahoma, into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Seems like we're going the other way. Now, one data point doesn't make a trend reversal, but it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens with Cushing inventory in weeks to come. The reason that we didn't see a huge bearish reaction to all of these really big inventory builds on crudes is because the finished products more than offset them, with gasoline drawing down 4.8 million barrels, distillate drawing down another 3.1 million barrels. So in total, that's 7.9, almost 8 million barrels of drawdowns in finished product inventory, offsetting 6.3 million barrels, including the SPR build, in total builds on crude oil inventory. So we're actually seeing a larger offsetting figure of large drawdowns in the finished products, offsetting the builds in crude oil. Tape action, that was really only modest reaction to the news coming out. We ended up drifting higher on the day Wednesday with the front month, even as those back of curve time spreads started rolling over yesterday afternoon. Then it was this morning when the front of the curve and the front month contract fell this morning, and it looks to me like there's still more downside to come. How much? I'm not sure. I've been surprised by this market. I thought because of the mounting evidence of the COVID-19 crisis lasting longer than a lot of people expected, a lot of reason to expect more demand destruction, I thought prices should have come off much sooner than they have. So it's been a delayed reaction. Does that mean it's going to be a smaller correction than I would have expected? Well, I guess we'll find out.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. A little bit of selling today, but overall, if it closes up here, we're going to have three closes above 1800. Now, that in a lot of people's eyes, that's a full-on breakout. But what's your take on this?
Well, we're almost there in terms of confirming this breakout. We got the daily closes above 1800, as you say. The next thing you look for is for it to start to move appreciably above that number. And we saw that as well. We saw a pretty significant move up. Then the next thing you look for is a retracement back down to test the previous resistance level and see if it becomes support. That's what happened today. We came back down and retested that 1800 number as support. So far, it's holding. Then the final test would be to move above yesterday's high, 1829, 1830, something like that, get a daily close up there, and that really, really confirms the breakout. Now, of course, a false breakout and a downside reversal to where we get a move significantly below 1800 and particularly below 1780, which arguably is where the technical breakout started, that would be very bearish. But no signs of that yet, and so far, my inclination is to think that we're headed towards this breakout confirming and moving higher on price.
Eric, what's your take on this 10-year treasury yield?
I was just going to ask you that question, Patrick. I'm turning the tables this week because I frankly don't have any real change to my view. What are you guys looking at?
Well, at Big Picture Trading, we've been looking at this 10-year treasury yield as the canary in the coal mine. And really, we have now seen, and today, a breakdown to the 60 basis point level on the 10-year yield. And what's interesting, even though we look back at the print down at spot 3.5 that occurred back in March, we have not really seen more than 24 hours of price action below the 60 basis point level on the three occasions it was tested. So we're right at that level. And to me, a breakdown in this 10-year treasury yield is a big deal. We have seen often the yields lead the stock market by even 3-4 weeks. And so if we start seeing this breakdown and follow through, especially below the support line, that to me is a warning signal and it's something that shouldn't be ignored. So it hasn't broken yet, but we had a pretty big down day today. And so it'll be really interesting to see whether this begins something much bigger. Nonetheless, this week's featured interview guest is Hugh Hendry. Now, Eric, why did we get Hugh back on the show this week?
Well, Hugh has been a favorite guest of our listeners. He's an incredibly outspoken and just remarkably candid and frank person, and also a very, very good big picture thinker. So who could be better to talk about some of these big picture trends in macro that we've been focusing on, like inflation and deflation and, you know, Fed money printing and MMT and so forth. So I think you're really going to enjoy this interview. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Hugh is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Hugh Hendry, famously the founder and fund manager for Eclectica Asset Management. Now, as our longtime listeners know, that fund was actually closed a couple of years ago. Hugh was interviewed here on Macro Voices the final day of Eclectica's operations, and it took a little bit of time off, and boy, Hugh Hendry is back. So, Hugh, it's great to have you. Tell us about coming back into the world of macro. What have you been doing for the last couple of years, and what brought you back?
Well, they say heaven is a place where nothing really happens, and I think I can concur with that. I've spent several years now in dividing my time between Europe and St. Barts, the island of St. Barts in the French Caribbean. And I have to say to you that I fear that I was changing role, if you will, from a hedge fund manager to a villa manager. And whilst I think I was way too qualified as a villa manager, I was, towards the end of last year, beginning to fear that I was becoming somewhat irrelevant, and I thought I could do more. But the role of the villa was that back in the day, this goes back almost 10 years, I had been conceiving of this beautiful place, St. Barts, and I had been looking at numbers, which not only was it a beautiful place, but it had a beautiful financial, kind of potentially a beautiful financial footprint. So I've invested quite a lot of money commercially, and my properties there are commercial properties and not, you know, not for my exclusive use. But one of the perks is I certainly get to spend a lot of time and pursuing my passion of being in a warm climate with warm water. So I surf every day, or I have to say I attempt to surf. And then I know a lot of people get quite tipsy about this. I do stand up surfing and not the kind of lie down and kind of lords and ladies leaping. But like all of these things, when you don't begin as a child, you have to go through the rigmarole of 10,000 times before you achieve excellence. And I fear I'm stuck somewhere around 1,783 attempts. But nevertheless, I'm looking forward to many more days like that.
Well, you've certainly made a splash with a piece that you've got out. It's a little over 30 pages. It's called Put Joe Rogan in Charge of the Fed. And this is available. Listeners, you'll find it linked in your Research Roundup email. I highly recommend that you download it and have a look. We may discuss some of the charts that it contains in this interview, but it's definitely worth a read. And it's large type, so it's a 30-pager, but it really reads like a 10-pager. You start with this graph I just love, which is obviously a little bit tongue-in-cheek, I guess, where you're kind of twisting the usual financial conversation on its head. And you're saying, look, if we look at the price of stocks relative to the expansion of central bank balance sheets, well, by that measure, stocks are crashing. They're not barely even managing to keep up with the rate of money supply expansion that's going on in central banks. Why did you start with that chart, and what message are you trying to send us?
Well, I started because back at the end of April, I reemerged, if you will. I came out and I started pontificating, and I discovered that Twitter is kind of cool. I think I've always been one who had these kind of cartoon-like thought bubbles, hopefully with more common sense than books. And people started sharing data and what have you. And people started kind of putting my name associated and attaching it to some of their messages. And I saw this chart, or I saw a variation of the chart, which was trying to demonstrate that the entire bull market moved to the upside. The entire recovered bulls of late 2008 disappear in their entirety when you handicap them by the growth in the Fed's balance sheet. And that kind of plays into, I spent 2 years, like I say, on a French island. And actually, since the end of 2018, I've been keeping an apartment in Paris. And so I seem to be drawn to French philosophers. And there's a lot of French philosophy that kind of underlay the movie The Matrix, with those kind of Fed-like guys who dodged the bullets in slow motion. And you had Morpheus, I think, back in 2014 in one of my investor letters. I had played with this notion that Morpheus had offered Neo the option of taking a blue pill and remaining blissful, not having to confront reality. Or he could take the red and kind of suffer the consequences. And the consequences are the world looks radically different when presented with the truth. So the question was, is this the truth? Has the Fed invented reality of the Fed, which is stock prices being that much higher? And so I wanted to examine that. And I found my old thinking mind taking shape. So for me, I wanted more data. I wanted 50 years of data. I wanted to go back to 1980. I think we are towards the end of a 50-year cycle. And there is an irony in that 50 years ago, with these kind of legendary names, these ghostly names such as Volcker and Reagan and Friedman and Thatcher, that there was actually a strong and revolutionary movement afoot to constraining the money supply. And of course, here we are 50 years later, and we're not trying to constrain or rein it in, but we're trying to expand it, which kind of made me laugh somewhat. But anyway, the first adjustment was, give me data, give me more data. And then the first true kind of credible test is, there's one thing to create nominal price increases, but have prices been rising in real terms? So let's handicap it for consumer price inflation. Now, of course, of late, that has not become a very onerous test because we have not had much in the way of recorded inflation. And so one could conclude with the blue pill and blissfulness. Equity prices have continued to make both nominal and real highs And of course, we've bounced pretty close back to those nominal highs that we had earlier in the year. And then finally, the presumption was, well, hey, heck, actually, let's just examine it one step further, because I don't like the Fed's balance sheet since the year 2000 has gone from pretty much zero as a percentage of GDP. And once we wring out all of the promises made in terms of trying to save us from the economic calamity, which is this damn virus, the Fed's balance sheet could be one times GDP, US GDP, which is to say $20-21 trillion. So if you deflate anything by $21 trillion, I draw a question mark over it. I thought it would be more relevant. I thought it would be more relevant to handicap it by private sector banks. I want to look at entrepreneurial banking, not public sector banking. I want to look at the expansion of risk takers. And always the biggest and the principal factor in M2, the broad market, it's commercial bank lending, it's commercial bank asset growth. Which is the metric which matters. And as Japan demonstrated, if we go back a long time, again, if we go back into this kind of 40, 50-year time window, but when Japan and the Nikkei had its great March high prices, it was a function of the banks were just gushing out money. You know, they were growing their balance sheets by 15% per annum. So that's a big handicap. But the prosperity that was being generated by that credit creation meant that stock prices were rising even faster. I was really perplexed to see that the highs, which were recorded by the tech bubble in December of 1999, when you come to denominate or handicap the US stock market, for that I'm talking about the Russell 3000, the widest kind of perspective of American enterprise, you find that high remains unchallenged by all the subsequent efforts. So that needs an explanation. And that explanation is found somewhere in the title to my paper, the reference to Joe Rogan and the subtitle of The Dawn of Chaos.
I want to come back to Joe Rogan and the Dawn of Chaos, but first, let me just understand your current perspective on the Fed and other central banks doing this radical balance sheet expansion. In the beginning, 2009, 2010, you were famously outspoken against these things. You described it as immoral what the Fed was doing to essentially bail out Wall Street at the expense of everyone else. And initially, it led you to a bearish market perspective. But after a while, I think it was around 2011 or so, you changed your tune. And what really surprised me, I was expecting you to say, okay, look, I've realized that, you know, even though it might be immoral, what these people are doing has to support stock prices because they just keep printing more money and it ends up going into asset markets. But if I remember correctly, you didn't say that. What you seem to be saying, okay, I got it wrong and they got it right, almost as if they were doing the right thing to be expanding central bank balance sheets so dramatically. So help me understand what you think now. Was all of this a good idea? I mean, they've certainly rescued the stock market, if that's what you think the purpose of central banks is. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? And where is it all headed from here?
You're correct in that I became a moral clergyman, if you will. I became this kind of, I was like the son of a preacher man, and I was proclaiming, you know, damnation to central banks for not purging, you know, the rottenness from the system. And I found myself quite outspoken and on television channels between 2009 and 2011. At the end of 2012, I committed that transformation and I repented or recanted. And I said that I come to recognize that my role in my calling as was then, which was as a performance manager, looking after the assets of other folk, it was not to pontificate, but it was to perform. And I found that liberating. And in terms of right or wrong, these again are heavily loaded terms, and I'm going to try and avoid those terms. What I want to say is that here we are sitting in the year 2020, and I have to say that the course that we have adopted that's taken us to here and now seems not bad when confronted with how precarious the world seemed in the final quarter of 2008. I think we're too quick to forget that, you know, it was not a truly outrageous proposition to imagine that we could have had some form of Great Depression 2.0. And depression of that magnitude, what that typically means is unemployment, which can be in excess of 20%. It can mean a generation that just misses out on life, life's end prematurely. Depressions, I think, are to be avoided at all cost. And I want to say to you that they are typically a function of the ideology of the men and the ladies who run these large organizations. So, you know, here we are and we've had the longest economic expansion and stock markets are higher and borrowing costs are kind of low. And people who want a job pretty much have a job. Again, if we can, I'm not sure if we can, but you know, it's not the Fed's fault that we got a virus. And so all of these comments pertain to the life as we knew it before February and March of this year. So you might say, hey, wow, so you're giving the Fed gets a get out of jail card. And so kind of. So that's me being kind. Let me go on the offensive. The offensive is that the Fed is full of baloney, that it keeps saying that it's printing money and it keeps making these outrageous statements that it seems that it's gone, you know, that it's created about $20 trillion of new dollars. And that's just nonsense. And it's not necessarily the Fed's fault. I think we all have to take responsibility because we all seem to believe them. We're buying it, like from the smallest investor to the kind of longest served, smartest investor you meet. They'll tell you, hey, these jerks from the Fed are printing all this money. It's going to be a disaster. I don't know where these people lost their senses. Expanding central bank reserves is not creating money. Why do we know that? We know that because stock prices haven't gone up enough. We know that because when denominated by commercial bank lending growth, stock prices are not rising. We know that because from the first quarter in 2009, when the Fed embarked on this strategy, the US dollar has risen. If we look at it on the DXY, the first quarter of 2009, we were somewhere between 85 and 90. Let's call it 87. And today we're at 97. So we've gone up 10 big points. That doesn't sound. I don't see a surging money supply. I don't see inflation. You know, the Milton Friedman comment that inflation is and always is everywhere. What is it, a monetary phenomenon? Well, okay, either we've not had a monetary phenomenon and that's why we have no inflation, or we have to like have a serious conversation. So short answer is let's leave morals out of the game, out of the discussion. Second point, like the path from 2009 to here, not bad, could have been a heck of a lot worse. The most disappointing aspect has been the absurdity of how we've come to distribute wealth and income and the disparity, which really I think is going to be the biggest issue. And I think we're going to return to that in this conversation. And then finally, we need some grown-ups in the room. And that's what I'm trying to do with my paper. I'm trying to call everyone out and say, can we please stop claiming that the Fed is printing money? Because as long as we perpetrate that nonsense, we're not going to find a solution.
I definitely want to come back to the wealth inequality subject, and I agree with you. That really is the crux of all of this. But first, I just want to touch on where this pattern of monetary policy could be headed next, because it seems to me that if you look at the response to the coronavirus crisis, it seems like, okay, for a while they were kind of trying to play this. We've got a lot of critics who say we shouldn't be expanding our balance sheet. Then we got to the coronavirus crisis and the floodgates opened, and they're just, you know, for a while it was a couple of trillion dollars a week of new fiscal and monetary stimulus. It seems to me that, and we'll come back to the wealth inequality subject in just a minute, but it seems to me like pretty soon politicians are going to insist that some of this money that has been bailing out financial markets start being directed at Main Street. And eventually it does lead to consumer price inflation. Am I right to think that that's the direction, if we look at the current trajectory of monetary policy, that eventually we get MMT, we get more money going into the real economy, and it gives us inflation? And if that's right, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? What should we expect in terms of the direction that current policy is likely to take us in? After you answer that, I want to come back to the much bigger question of wealth inequality.
Well, that's their best hope. And you know, the notion of Chairman Bernanke, the former Federal Reserve Chairman, and his helicopter money, it really only had resonance when you were able to have these helicopter drops of money and distribute it to, you know, the ordinary Joe, if you will. I hate that expression. The problem with quantitative easing is that it's pretty much gone to rich folk. And so we've had this phenomenon of having no vim in velocity, if you will, in having this all of these inert bank reserves being created and not being exchanged for anything in the real economy, and therefore not bidding up real prices. I still think it's still part of the same charade. It's still part of the same faulty thinking. There has been a little bit. I mean, as you say, the fiscal stimulus, it is remarkable. The big numbers that were announced, it's remarkable how little the check was to the guy in the street. But like over time, that will expand. But Japan's done that. Japan sent checks to households, begging them to spend it. And it's not obvious that people spend it. And that's, again, why I wrote the paper, because the bind, and again, it's really not meant to be a critique of our public bureaucrats. And I know that they're charged with an impossible task and that they work damn hard, and you know they certainly work just as hard as their brethren at hedge funds and other investment houses, and you know they certainly don't get paid anything like the same. The difficulty for policymakers is that 50 years ago, like I say, with Volcker, when we were trying to constrain growth, that society was, if you go back to the 1970s, the late 60s and the early 70s, the world was chaotic, you know, from the Vietnam War. We had a president assassinated, if we go back further enough, long enough. We had the withdrawal from Vietnam. We had the American society tearing itself apart. You know, a young generation viewed with suspicion by its elders. We had the oil price quadruple overnight. You know, you had to queue round the block for days to get gas for your car. We had that awful event with trying to get the hostages out of Iran. And people were saying, I'm done. I'm done with chaos. Give me order. And order is something that's kind of, it's a kind of an easier ask when you're turning to, you know, elected politicians and elected members. Give me order. It's something they can fulfill. Today, we're at the end of this orderly progression. Our lives, our economies have been orderly, and there's been an orderly march of the rise and rise and rise of our form of capitalism, and we've liberated billions of people across the world. But we're getting tired of it. And so now we're tired of order. And order only has, the antithesis of order is chaos, is disorder. And that's what is hard for the Fed to deliver. And so the Fed is trying to be chaotic. And, you know, Jay Powell, Chairman Powell, is, you know, he's been on daytime TV. He doesn't take his tie off, but he's been on daytime TV. They don't like being on daytime TV. And he is kind of trying to sound a little bit wild. He's like, you know, we're printing money. They never say that. If you go back in the annals of time, Fed chairmen don't say that. So they kind of, you know, they're trying to be a little bit crazy, but at the end of the day, it's Jay Powell. And so, like I say, with the virus, he says we're standing with the American household. We've just printed, like, I don't know, $4 or $7 trillion. Who cares? Like, call it $10 trillion. And the credit markets just go, oh, really? Is that the best you can do? The best that you can do is to print more of these inert banking reserves. That it's the same status quo. And so what we saw, despite the rally in equity prices. We saw the 10-year Treasury hit 50 basis points because the brains in the system, the credit markets are saying, you ain't printing money. This is, we're on the edge. We're on the edge of disinflation or downright deflation. For the stock market, for all that we say that the stock market is up, and it is up, but for all that it is up, the stock market is being just as intelligent as the credit market. The stock market has essentially separated, identified a group of businesses that we would regard as being perpetual growth machines. And maybe they won't be, but these FANG stocks. And it's identified others where the predictability of growth seems assured. And those are the stocks which are really determining the shape and the trend and the current of the marketplace. The rest, everything else, has been derated. Equity risk premiums have gone up to reflect that the average stock today is riskier than it was 5 years ago. It's riskier than it was 10 years ago.
Well, I do want to come back to what I think you and I probably agree is the core issue facing society, not facing markets, but facing society right now, I think, is the wealth inequality that exists in society and which I feel has been perpetuated and exaggerated by government policy, particularly by central bank policy, but also by other policies. And I'll tell you, Hugh, when I was a young man in my 20s, and I would hear people around me whining and complaining, saying, oh, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You know, I'd say, you know what? I came from very humble beginnings. My family was not wealthy. I went to a vocational high school, and I worked damn hard. And I was able to build a business, and by my mid-20s, I was better off than most people twice my age. And that's because I was born in a country that at that time offered a form of capitalism where it didn't matter what family you were from, even if you didn't have an Ivy League degree. If you worked your ass off and you were smart, you could be successful. And I really didn't believe that richer getting richer and poorer getting poorer. I thought of it as people feeling sorry for themselves, and I didn't think it was legitimate. If I look at the last 10 years, I see very clearly that what's going on is we have government policy, which has been fantastically successful at bailing out the investor class at the expense of the general populace. And as one of the one percenter guys who's supposed to, you know, be the beneficiary of this, I don't feel like the beneficiary. I feel like the pitchforks are coming. I'm surprised it's taken them this long. And of course, now with all the unrest we're seeing, it's getting very real. And something I'm noticing just in our macro voices listener base, you know, you would think a show like this that's about markets and investing would be, you know, for rich guys. It's for people who are investors, who are traders and so forth. I've got a tweet in front of me right now that I want to read for our audience to give you a sense of who is listening to Macro Voices. This fellow says, Eric, love the show. It's fantastic. I love you and George Gammon. I'm a union iron worker, and in the last 6 months, I've been working to educate myself and learn as much as I can about how all this stuff works. You know what's going on, I think, Hugh, is the have-nots, and I don't mean to insult this gentleman by calling him a have-not, but I'm assuming as a union iron worker that he's not in the 1%. They're smart guys, too. They're educating themselves to figure out exactly what the hell has happened to them, how they've gotten screwed. They want to understand it so that they're in a position to really force change. And I think that they're well justified in wanting that change. Are we on the same page? Do you see it differently? What do you think?
We're on the same page. And so it's redolent of the late 1920s. You know, this is the, it feels like a novel from back then, The Great Gatsby. And the problems are very, very similar. So the fun that I was having, like, give me Joe Rogan running the Fed, okay? What I mean by this, I would rather we radicalize some of these financial institutions and get different policy responses than we just allow the status quo to pervade, because that road is leading to the radicalization of the political economy. To my original kind of thesis, if inflation is not a monetary phenomenon, what is it? It's a social phenomenon. And if we don't find solutions, and we don't find solutions out of radical kind of new thought leadership, then society is going to find solutions, and they're going to be dark, and they're going to be nasty, and they're going to be angry, and it's going to tear us apart. So the risks related to the Fed's policy are got nothing to do with how high stock prices go. And they've got everything to do about how we get through the next presidential election in the United States, because we can't, it's a ticking bomb. And so I want to offer solutions. We'll come back to Joe, but the Fed's moment, I think the Fed has to be rested a little bit. The original premise was correct. We needed to ease policy for, let's call it, the ordinary Joe. And the Fed gave it a go. They created almost $20 trillion of these kind of boring, useless Federal Reserve check accounts, let's call them, okay? Didn't work, okay? They're probably going to expand the balance sheet by another one times GDP. So let's have another agent have a go. And that other agent for me would be the U.S. Treasury. The U.S. Treasury is responsible for the dollar. Okay. The dollar has gone up, like I say, it's gone up in the last 12 years from 87 to 97. It should have gone down. That would have given a break to your union guy. So how do we get it down? It's very simple. The Treasury steps up to the plate and it says, "Dear Wall Street, we want, and indeed we insist, that the dollar is going to trade lower, and we would like to see it trading in the 60s. And you know what? When you give that cue to investors and you say, the U.S. Treasury is telling you, you should be selling the dollar, okay? And we're coming for you, okay? And people are going to sell the dollar. Pretty quickly, the dollar is going to fall to 60. And it's going to cause pandemonium in China and pandemonium in Germany and all these other places that have these huge current account reserve surpluses with America. Now, they're not going to sit idly by, but what they're going to do is they're going to print their own currency, and they're going to use that currency to go into the foreign exchange market and buy dollars to try and stop the dollar falling. So they're going to try and support the dollar and push it back up. And in doing so, they're going to buy dollar assets. This is already happening. It happens in Switzerland. The Swiss Central Bank owns billions of dollars of Apple and other large American companies and U.S. Treasury bonds because its currency rises. And I think one day, if the Treasury were to take control of the situation and try and find a means to actually print money, and printing money would be taking away this targeting of bond prices and target the external value of the dollar. So what I kind of, I feel like, you know, those letters and that critique and that anger that you have and that your listeners have, it's the same as people had at the end of the 1920s. What was going on then was that the world did not have enough gold in order to finance credit. And without credit, you couldn't create new businesses and you couldn't create new factories and you couldn't create, you know, new ideas and new services, etc. The world was being starved of the financial means to expand. And we found a solution when the dollar devalued. And it devalued dramatically vis-a-vis the price of gold in 1934. The answer is very similar today. We have to devalue the dollar. The dollar is the gold standard of the 1920s.
Hugh, you said in the paper that you strongly feel that devaluing the dollar is a good move. That's what we need to do. So let me take this to the next step, because when you say, you know, Joe Rogan for Fed chair, obviously you're being facetious in saying that. But let's consider what some people think would be a serious suggestion for the Fed, which is somebody like Stephanie Kelton. Put the modern monetary theory crew in charge of the Fed with the goal of basically, you know, the people who are the inventors of MMT, they do understand inflation. They know it's a real deal. But their strategy would basically be just devalue the dollar as much as you can without creating runaway inflation. And a lot of our guests have been very outspoken in saying that should be our greatest fear, because it would lead, even though those people wouldn't see it coming, it would lead to runaway inflation, to hyperinflation, which would lead to an inflationary greater depression. So is MMT and that whole crowd a bad idea for that reason, or is it a good idea because it would achieve what you say we need to do, which is dramatically devalue the dollar?
I don't like endorsing expert opinions. such as you mentioned. I think that the problem with the world is there are too many experts. The problem that I had with the virus is that our lives are now controlled by medical experts. I don't trust experts. I'm sure I'm not alone in saying, you know, if you want to change my behavior, give me data. And bizarrely across the world, whilst we've generated a huge amount of data of late, governments are not sharing it. These experts are not sharing it. And I made a fortune in my career by betting always against experts. So that's why I would rather have a mixed martial arts artiste, if you will, than a modern monetary theorist running the Federal Reserve. But to the point that the policies which I'm suggesting would sound kind of similar to MMT, and it would be profoundly, and hyperinflation is a profound word, it doesn't need any extra help. Hyperinflation, if hyperinflation is to happen, it's not going to happen in the US. And the US does have some advantage in being, you know, the reserve currency of the world. And the hyperinflation that would, this is all hypothetical, but were the dollar to devalue dramatically, and there will be an economic region in the world which will happily sit there and feel kind of good that its currency has appreciated versus the US dollar by 20 or 30%. And that poor, unfortunate continent, its economy will suffer. It will suffer greatly under the duress of having a currency which is much stronger than the US. And eventually, that through that sufferance, the citizens of that country will radicalize and they will get very angry. And they will change those politicians and they will get very, very angry and radical politicians. And that's where you will get to see hyperinflation. People are scaring you too much today. So let's, this year, the US government will run an exceptional budget deficit. But they always say exceptional, but the budget deficit could be of the order of 25% of GDP. Now, to put that in context, the German Weimar economy, the economy ran after the defeat of Germany in the First World War, which is kind of ridiculed. The central bank is ridiculed as they made all of the worst decisions. And budget deficit of the Weimar government never exceeded 12 or 13% of GDP. So the US is on course to printing twice the worst figure ever economy in terms of economic logic. And yet the US is not on the verge of hyperinflation. Hyperinflation happened in Germany because they wanted to squeeze Germany even more in terms of reparations. And what they did was you had a divided society and judgment and anger. Everything just broke and people just turned on themselves. And you had these terrible death squads. And there was the assassination of a very prominent and popular politician who could have united Germany, and he was sadly killed. Same thing happened in Japan in the 1930s. The military, which started having firing squads, and they were killing Bank of Japan presidents. This is why it's very, very hard to convince the Bank of Japan to be irresponsible. In being irresponsible, you know, in the 1930s, you were killed for being irresponsible. So you can see, you know, it's like the passage, the Bible says, when asked, how does a rich man enter heaven? The kind of Bible, the Bible's very European and kind of sniffs at it and says, ooh, it's like trying to pass a camel through the eye of a needle. And that's what it's like. In trying to convince a central bank, you know, to be credibly irresponsible, it's the same, if you will. And so I come back to you again. I say we need Joe Rogan.
I'm going to shift subjects here completely because before we run out of time, I want to touch on this. You went from being, you know, running Eclectica Asset Management, City of London, wearing a necktie every day, being part of that financial engine of people whose job is to think really hard about the economy and business, even though they're not actually part of the real world of people who actually make things and deliver products and services for a living. You're kind of in that meta economy of thinking about how this works in the hedge fund world. You went from that to boots on the ground, hiking around on St. Bart's saying, what's the ideal place to put the next villa? And how do I think about using my skill as a macro guy to think about where there's a real estate investment that makes sense on one of the most beautiful islands in the Caribbean? How'd you get from City of London to the shores of St. Bart's? And particularly, how does that knowledge translation occur? How did macro play into your views that led you to be a property investor on St. Bart's?
So I think it's really all determined. It's my quantity theory again, but it's the quantity theory of rosé consumption. When you find yourself in the Caribbean in such a beautiful spot, you tend to drink a lot of rosé and have a rather good time. I was somewhat circumspect and my mind just never switches off. And so I was always kind of curious and asking prices about the business model of the local property market. So I'm very fortunate that perhaps I don't like rosé. And what I discovered was that St. Bart's is many things, but so if you're one of these billionaires, you're just like, you're kind of like anyone else. You kind of want to flaunt it. You want to show it. What's the point of having a private island? No one would see the majesty of your genius and your wealth. Yeah. No one would see your new yacht and your new girlfriend and all that nonsense. And so St. Bart's has this networking effect whereby it's the place that you go to be seen if you're sort of, you know, fantastically rich and successful. And it has a very, very long season, and which is a long way to saying that, you know, the commercial returns, depending on the price you pay, can be very interesting. And what I discovered was that I could come in and I could design. I discovered something of a flair for the design, the layout, the interior design, the look of the house. My house is Maison Blanc, Blanc Bleu. Blanc Bleu in St. Bart's, you get an impression of one of our principal properties over there. And what I discovered is that you could generate, certainly with investments of the vintage around 2015, that you could generate a very attractive positive carry in this real asset and in this rare exclusive asset. They're not making any more St. Bart's, and the planning permission is getting tougher and tougher, which is to say you would never get permission to build the size of house that I was permitted to build back in 2015. So you have that rarity. And of course, today I can borrow money from European banks at 1.3%, and I can fix it at 1.3% for the next 20 years. And so a house which is in the most beautiful place, that's this well bid that lots of rich folk really want to come and stay, and a house where the clients pay the financing costs, and so you get to own a portfolio of beautiful houses in the rare confinement of St. Bart's, using other people's money and accepting US dollars. So I keep saying to people, I feel like I'm in the Truman Show, and that I actually have gone from managing a macro portfolio to actually being a participant in my macro portfolio. It's just when I look out the window, it's a lot more attractive than it was when I was in London.
Hugh, before we close, I want to touch on a film that you've been starring in, a short film. Now, you'd think that a macro guy, City of London hedge fund manager, being in a film around the time that you're kind of making a comeback or reintroducing yourself to the world of macro, this has got to be a very stodgy, you know, tweed jacket, necktie kind of affair. But behind the scenes, the word leaking out on the street is that's not what it's about at all. What is going on? How did we get from Hugh Hendry fund manager to Hugh Hendry movie star? And what's the film about?
It's about me. It's about me wanting to make finance cool, because again, inflation is more and more, I believe, a social phenomenon, and I want people to find answers. And so I want to make finance accessible. The problem, my perception of finance is dull. I know that we're all passionate, but we're kind of like a closed shop. And I want to open the thing up. I don't want titles. Like I said to you, I have disdain for experts. I want Joe Rogan running the Fed. I want former hedge fund managers like me becoming movie stars, if you will. My thing, which despite being dogged by this dengue fever, I gave it everything. I hammed it up as much as I could. And you will see me boxing, speaking to dancers, to circus performers on my electric skateboard, zooming through tunnels in Paris, trying to recreate the world of Brodie Lahr, who is the one of the exceptional minds behind this whole idea of the Matrix. The Matrix really is a recurring theme because we're in a world today where it is binary between those, you know, be ignorant with the blue pill and live a blissful life. But of course, we want people to take that red. We want people to see the truth. And I kind of want to offer them some answers to all of these questions that they have. How can I protect myself? And sometimes, for me at least, I always found that visually seeing things, you know, we're constantly REM processing our subconscious. And for me, I always found a link to solutions and to understanding the conclusion when I was like watching a movie or reading like a very well-crafted magazine article. And so my hope is that the more we can make some joyful and fun expressions, I want people to laugh at me. I want people to say, you know, what an ass, who does he think he is? But at the same time, I'm hoping that we just might release a few things in that REM process where at the end of the day, people might be saved the worst of the chaos which is coming down the road.
Hugh, as I piece this all together, you were just an extremely well-known, very outspoken hedge fund manager in your days at Eclectica Asset Management. All of the sudden, you've got this Joe Rogan for the Fed chair paper. You're making a short film. You've got a new presence on Twitter and on social media. I think you've got a YouTube channel now. These are all of the ingredients of reintroducing the Hugh Hendry brand to an audience that remembers Hugh Hendry, the fund manager. And it feels to me like you're reintroducing the Hugh Hendry brand as something else other than fund manager. Well, what's the something else? What's the end game? Where is all of this headed?
It's simple, Eric. I just dropped the D at the end of the word fund, and it's become fun. The only way I was coming back is if I was going to have some fun. So I don't know if I'm ready to commit yet, but I'm definitely looking for something which is a radical departure from what we're used to seeing in the world of finance. Let's leave it with, I want to, you know, let's make finance cool.
That sounds to me like it's still a secret, and I guess we'll look forward to getting you back on the show when you're ready to talk in more detail about it. Meanwhile, let's just tell people about the film. When is that to be released?
So the film, I'm presently trying to get my website out, and that'll be another 3-4 weeks, and the film will coincide with that. And of course, it'll be on YouTube. I've got a YouTube channel, which is Hugh Hendry Official, which is a bit silly. At some point, we may drop the official and it'll just be Hugh Hendry.
And of course, you are on Twitter as Hendry_Hugh. And if anyone wants to see Hugh's beautiful home on St. Bart's, it is yours for a mere $35,000 a week. I guess that's the starting price. And you can just Google Blanc Bleu. And of course, it's French, so blue is spelled BLEU, like blue cheese.
And don't forget to find me at Hugh Hendry Official on Instagram. I think I'm the only former hedge fund manager. I promise you, I'm not wearing a bikini. Maybe I will have to wear a bikini, but we have fun on Instagram.
And of course, Instagram is just way too cool for our finance audience. So anybody who doesn't know, that's the hip social media website to be on. We're going to need to leave it there in the interest of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, you weren't kidding when you were saying that Hugh was going to be outspoken. What an interview. What did you take away from all of it?
You know, Patrick, the thing that really struck me is all of the smartest guys are moving into hard assets away from financial assets. Obviously, Hugh's love for the island of St. Barts is personal in nature, but, you know, he's looking not just at his own residence there, but potentially developing more villas and getting involved in commercial real estate development. Why is a macro guy like Hugh Hendry, who's, you know, used to trading, you know, flatteners on treasury yields or something, getting into being a property developer? I think it's because all the smartest guys in the room see this major trend away from financialized assets into hard assets. In fact, I just did another spotlight interview this week. We did one, as our listeners remember, a while back around securitized fine art investing. I just recorded one that's going to air tomorrow morning with a gentleman who was working for a private equity fund in Canada. His job is buying farmland because that's just incredibly big trend that a lot of people are looking at farmland. And he wants to buy it himself, and he's not able to because unless you've got enough money to buy entire farms, that investment just doesn't make sense. So he developed this company that's basically securitizing investment in farmland, making it available to all accredited investors, which it wasn't previously. I think that trend of more and more assets that have been the favored trades of billionaires getting securitized so that all accredited investors can get into them is going to continue. So that interview is going to air on Friday morning. Be sure to check that one out as well. Meanwhile, folks, you'll find the link in your Research Roundup email for this week's post-game chart book. You're not going to want to miss the chart deck because we're going to be referring to the graphs and charts that it contains for the rest of today's episode. Again, that download link is in Research Roundup. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, look for the red button that says looking for the downloads. Patrick, page 2, dollar index. This is the chart that I wanted to talk to in our market round. Sure enough, you know, we're not back down below that yellow line at 96, but if we get a daily close below there, it's awfully hard not to start to think in a pretty bearish light about this chart. What do you see here? What do you expect?
When I look at this chart, I look and I say, like, really, we have not seen a major reversal of trend. I mean, there is no denying that the dollar had a blow off going into that March event. And since then, it's been backing off. But we are entering a period where even if we break that 96 level, there is a very extended consolidation period that lies between 94 to 96. And arguably, even if the path of least resistance is for the dollar to immediately weaken, you know, let's say the TGA account is, and the Treasury pushed the dollar lower. Maybe we see an impulse of the dollar index from 96 down to 94, or the euro makes that breakout to 117. These things can all happen on the very short term. But is that a major new trend? I'm not convinced yet. I mean, I think that while there is definitely room for it to weaken, I think that that could maybe still develop into a buying opportunity for the dollar. It'll be really interesting to see.
What would persuade you? What's the number? Is it 94.5, 94? Where does the daily close need to come in to tell you that this chart is really taking a dive to the south side?
Well, it wouldn't be necessarily just breaking of a level, but rather the way it behaves after it does, right? Because the first thing that you would expect is that if we saw that impulse lower of a couple Dixie points down toward 94, you would expect that buy on dip traders would scoop that up and get it back north of 96 in short order over the following weeks. And if we see that a breakdown like that is rather having failed rallies and remains very weak in price action, that would be the more concerning thing. So it's more about what would happen down there than it actually breaking a specific price level.
Patrick, let's move on to commodity futures on page 3. Looks like we are seeing a sustained breakout around that yellow consolidation range that you have drawn on the chart here. What's this chart telling you? What do you think comes next?
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we played the game Breakout or Fake Out, and we were looking at the actual dip that was occurring there at the very tail end of June. And instead, commodities just started to rip. The dollar sort of rolled over and these commodities all popped. And really, the next few charts is a series of commodities that I wanted to highlight that are all in line with this. And we were also a couple of weeks ago talking about those lumber futures as to whether or not that breakout was going to sustain. And not only did it sustain on page four, but we broke out, we beat all the highs of 2019 and 20 in just one fluid motion. So, you know, what is driving this demand for lumber and so many of these commodities? It's even when we look at page five, we see that the copper prices have not only V-bottomed off of that big sell-off in March, but we're right up along those 2019 highs that were just under $3. And it really is, we're going to get a big tell to find out whether or not these commodities start to really break out here.
And if they do, Patrick, it certainly would be in line with the discussion we had with Hugh Hendry today in the feature interview about inflation and the trends that we're seeing in markets. We've got iron ore futures on page six. Now, last time we talked about iron ore futures, you and I were uncertain as to what caused that big spike in prices in May, and we were inundated with listener emails explaining that iron ore comes not only from Australia, but also from Brazil, and it was the Brazilian iron ore production that was encumbered by the COVID-19 crisis that resulted in that big price spike in May. But it looks like after we got through that and came back down and consolidated for a while, it looks like we're seeing another breakout here. What's going on?
Well, this is the bigger trend, isn't it? And that I'm trying to capture here, which is one of the bigger drivers behind commodities tends to be a weaker U.S. dollar. And so the fact that we're seeing that U.S. dollar so weak and rolling down, all of these commodities are catching a really nice tailwind. And many of them are breaking out. And I guess they didn't get the memo about there being a global recession. But right now, definitively, iron ore is breaking to, again, a higher high. It's consolidated up there. It continues to behave very well. And what's interesting is that even when we go to wheat futures on page seven, we're finally seeing wheat, soybean, corn, all of them actually had an incredible week breaking out of that descending channel that has been in place since April. And so commodities are all breaking out. So is this the beginning of a big new commodity move or not? It's one of the really interesting puzzle pieces to watch in the coming weeks and months.
Now, of course, we have not yet seen the S&P break out to new all-time highs, but holy cow, look at page eight and the FANG Plus Index. What's going on here?
Yeah, I really wanted to just highlight where that momentum is. And, you know, throughout the years at Macro Voices, we've had the opportunity to talk our listeners through a number of these bubble parabolic rises and inevitably their turnarounds and the corrections that come on the other side. And it's amazing to see that in the last week, we saw an actual acceleration of the steepness of the slope on these FANG stocks. Like the money is just chasing, the FOMO is driving this outright acceleration. It feels very similar to what we've seen in almost all bubbles, which is that the slope continues to rise and the speed of the ascent is actually increasing. Now, that one thing that you'll always point out about bubbles is the fact that these things, you don't really know how high they will go. When things get into this parabolic phase, it's always shocking how far they're able to push it. So in no way am I saying that the FANGs can't clear 5,000 and keep going, but it's definitely feeling very bubble-ish in terms of this, the rate of change and the speed from which this is ascending.
Now, what's driven Tesla on page nine to this just huge blow off in the last week? I've been reading a little bit about it becoming a popular Robin Hood stock. Is that the driver, or is there more to it than that?
I wish I knew. All I know is that there is a fever going on for this Tesla. And it's amazing because it literally looks the same as the chart on page eight for the FANG stocks. It's just an acceleration of this. And it's one of those scenarios where, you know, Tesla, will it blow off to 1,500 and 1,700? Will we see this just continue? It is amazing to watch this rise. The premiums and the volatility premium is so rich. I know last time around you were throwing some of those call options out there. Are you thinking of writing a little bit this time around, Eric?
I don't know what to make of this, Patrick. It is just so crazy. As far as I'm concerned, Tesla still has a fair value of under $20 a share. It's never been worth more than that. But I mean, just look at it. In the last week, we've gone from 1,000, which was a crazy number for Tesla, you know, up 40% from there. It sure does feel like the beginning of a blow off to me. But the question is, how high can it go before
and it can go higher?
The insanity right? ends. I mean, why not 2,000? Why not?
You know, listen, if all of our listeners are playing Tesla and they're playing that musical chairs, it's a greater fool thing, which is that you just need to make sure that you're not the one stuck holding the bag. Long as you can flip it to someone who's willing to pay a higher price, you can play. And it's just when the music stops, you got to make sure that you have an exit strategy, right?
Yeah, I think the music's going to stop very abruptly on this one. I'm not sure that it's time yet, but when it does stop, well, look out below.
So going on to chart 10, and this is where I think there's some really interesting divergences. So what we have is a basket of these stocks that are really getting all of the money flow. The FOMO is just pouring into these big names. That's where their performance is. That's where all the managers are getting their price action. One interesting thing, though, is that the Dow Jones Industrial Index didn't get the memo. What we continue to see is a scenario where we've seen most stocks have actually topped in early June. And we have not seen any of them have any sign of wanting to participate on the upside. The breadth continues to diverge from that. And with the fact that the yields are breaking down, like we talked about in the market wrap, it is really interesting to see whether or not the broader stock market will get another wave of buying. Maybe this is just going to focus completely on those FANG stocks, and they're the ones that will run in the last phase, and maybe the broader markets are already done. It'll be really interesting to see.
Patrick, talk to me about volatility and the VIX. You know, we had that big spike up in the beginning of June again, and it looks like we're almost back down to the lows that we got to around the 1st of June. What's going on here?
Well, one interesting observation to make is that, you know, during the entire bull market phase of the market, you know, even prior to this 2019 part that I'm showing, the volatility during that premium selling regime that existed back then was very low. I mean, we rarely saw the VIX spike above 20, and it stayed down in the low teens throughout majority of that period. What is interesting is, in spite of the NASDAQ making higher highs, in spite of the S&P 500 being a stone's throw from its major highs, we have not seen volatility normalize back down to those teen levels. It's staying at a very sustained high level. One of the interesting perspectives on that is that I think everyone is expecting some volatility into the elections. And this is where, in the corner here, I have the term structure of the VIX, which you can see has that kink in it, in the term structure going into that October-November election period. And so it'll be it's interesting that volatility is being priced relatively high. And then in the post-election period, we're seeing that they're already pricing in lower volatility. And so will this mean that this is going to be a sustained and elevated level for the next, you know, 3-4 months? It certainly feels that way, doesn't it?
And of course, if you really want to learn to master options trading and volatility, join Big Picture Trading. Info is available on page 12 about how you can get a free trial. Listeners, I want to ask a favor of you. We sure could use some help with rating and reviewing us on iTunes. We've got new and improved instructions for exactly step-by-step how to do that contained in your Research Roundup email. Those 5-star reviews will help us regain our former status as the best investing podcast on the network, and that's really helpful in terms of our being able to bring you more of the best feature interview guests. This episode was made possible by TopTradersOnPlugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at TopTradersOnPlugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit MacroVoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find a link to the transcript for today's interview, as well as the link to the article that Hugh Henry shared with us, as well as the chart book we just discussed in this postgame. There's also a link to an interesting video about Jeffrey Gundlach talking about the Fed's fiscal spending, as well as a link to an article from Jesse Felder on What Were You Thinking? Part 2. And so you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.